Hello there. Welcome to yet another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, and in this podcast, I speak to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast. Like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk, and check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. You can directly support this podcast, if you want, by taking advantage of a special offer for Turkey Book Talk listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. In that offer, you can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five excellent books published by Hearst. Check it out via the address hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Purchasing through that deal is cheaper than Amazon, and most importantly for me, it helps support this podcast. Titles included on the list are written by authors who have previously featured on Turkey Book Talk. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eşref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poisoned Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter, and Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State by Olivier Roy. To order any of those titles for a third off plus free delivery, visit hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com and help support Turkey Book Talk. Another way to support if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast is through my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. The standard pledge is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want. And you can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But now on with our latest episode, in which I speak to Suzy Hansen. She's reported from Turkey for 10 years for outlets including the New York Times Magazine, Vogue, and the London Review of Books. She's also the author of a new book called Notes on a Foreign Country, An American Abroad in a Post-American World, which is published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Over her time in Turkey, Hansen has tackled a range of big issues: Syrian refugees in suburban Istanbul, the deadly Soma industrial disaster, the Erdogan-Gulen power struggle, and the post-coup attempt crackdown. And she's built a reputation as one of the most sophisticated and sensitive journalists working on Turkey today. The articles she writes tend to be longer form, deeply reported explorations of a particular subject, and if you haven't read them yet, I'd urge you to do so. So I'll put links to a few of the pieces up at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. In Notes on a Foreign Country, Hansen reflects on her experiences reporting from Turkey and elsewhere, examining the dark side of US engagement in global affairs, and giving a searing critique of American amnesia. The book is her first. It's only just been published and it's garnered quite a bit of attention, so I started by asking Suzy Hansen to reflect on the reception of the book so far and the broader experience of writing and publishing it.
I'm very happy with the response. It's been really nice. I think that most of the reviews have really understood the intention of the book, which was mainly to explore what it means to be abroad as an American now in the 21st century, and what you learn when you are living abroad, what it tells you about your own country, and sort of your own weaknesses and prejudices, the weaknesses and prejudices that you discover when you are attempting to understand foreign countries. I think I sort of ended up discovering that Americans have kind of a unique problem in seeing the rest of the world clearly, because we are very much invested in this idea of course, our own exceptionalism, and this idea that a lot of the rest of the world wants to be like us. And I think these are kind of deeply, deeply unconscious assumptions that even the most well-intentioned and self-critical thinker might have. I think that they're almost like reflexes. And I think that, you know, there have been a few people I've spoken to who have been a little, I think, offended by the book. I mean, I think it kind of draws out exactly the response that you would expect, which is, well, wait a minute. You know, we have done good things. You know, can't we acknowledge that? In other words, America has done good things in the world. But I think that for the most part, because this is such a time of confusion in the U.S., I think people are open to critique and self-critique and to understanding American identity in different ways.
Yes, I mean, you were, of course, writing really generally during the Obama administration, but the book really does now seem to kind of chime with the times with Trump and all this sense of exhaustion and American decline.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, part of it is also, as I said, it's confusion. And I think that a lot of that, it goes back to September 11th and the confusion that happened after that tragic event. It was, you know, sort of, why did this happen? Where did this come from? What has actually been going on for the past 50 years? And I think that it really speaks to what I call, and I identify it in myself, a kind of American ignorance about what has been happening in the rest of the world vis-a-vis the United States. We are, to some degree, very detached from this relationship, meaning our relationship with the rest of the world and our foreign policy, but it has a lot to do with who we are and how we think. So I think that, you know, this might just be the beginning of trying to understand in new ways what that identity really is.
When you set out to write the book a few years ago, I'm guessing, were you always clear what the aim was from the start, or did you have any particular surprises as you were writing that the kind of writing went off in a tangent in any way?
I think I deliberately wanted to write a book that would be open like that. I mean, the proposal was very strange and vague, actually. It was just an essay in which I was proposing a lot of questions for the most part. And I mean, I think that the genesis of the book is kind of telling. I think that at first, when I moved abroad on this fellowship, I thought that I would end up someday, whether it was in a few years or 20 years, writing a book about just Turkey, because that was what I went abroad to do. Well, I went abroad to learn about Turkey. But some of my friends identified that I kept making these observations about America's history in Turkey, or how America looked from Turkey, or what foreigners were saying to me, and that I was seeing the United States for the first time in a different way. And these friends of mine said, you know, it seems like your book is actually about America. And I was horrified by this, because this was not what I thought I was, you know, sent abroad by this fellowship organization to do, which was to write about myself. I, you know, I didn't think it was to write about myself. I thought it was to write about others. But I think that, to be honest, as time went on and Turkey, I found so complex and so difficult to understand, that in fact this other narrative was asserting itself, which was, why is it difficult to understand? Why is it difficult for me to understand? And what are the perils of being an American observer abroad, being an American journalist abroad? And I wanted to first write about that process. It almost seemed like a cleansing in a way. And I also wanted, in terms of the process of the book, I wanted it to be a kind of free-floating form. I didn't want it to just be reportage or memoir or history. I wanted it to be a mix of both so that I could be creative with it. I mean, frankly, I'm a pretty private person, so the memoir part of it was not easy for me. But I came to find that, you know, I wasn't going to be super critical of someone else's psychology. The only person's psychology I could kind of rip apart was my own. And so I felt that I had to look very, very deeply within to examine my own prejudices and the way that my thinking had evolved. So that, you know, and I also wanted to read. I mean, a lot of this project was reading. I just read a ton of really great books, academic books, foreign writers, especially foreign writers. And I tried to understand these different perspectives and sort of fill in the gaps of my knowledge. And that was just a really wonderful experience. So I think that in the end, I think that the way that it came together in the very end, to be honest. And the way that this experience of going to Soma and realizing the effects of Erdogan's economic policy, and then going to Mississippi in my own country and understanding the economic policies there and the similarities between the two. I mean, all of this kind of came together in the end. I didn't know what the book was going to look like from the beginning. I really didn't.
Yes, the book opens in Soma. It's, this is a small town in western Turkey, which was the site of this terrible industrial disaster at the coal mine in May 2014, in which 301 people were killed. And it was the worst industrial accident in Turkey's history. Why did you choose to open the book with such an episode?
I think it was, at the time that I was writing it, it was the freshest to me. I mean, to be quite honest, I think that was one of the most emotional experiences I've had as a reporter in general, in Turkey for sure, and in general. I just think that that was a real moment where I felt that there was a different kind of brutality going on between the government and its citizens, and a sort of hardness. And I think that also, you know, it's surprised me. And so it reminded me of my own naivete once again. And I think that it also reminded me of my own failures. I think that, you know, this is a part of the narrative of the book, which is that when I first came to Turkey the first time, I think that I was very distracted by this narrative, this Islam versus secularism narrative. And I didn't really look at Turkey through different lenses. And I think that I myself really neglected to follow what what was going on with Erdogan's economic policies. I mean, I wasn't writing that much in the first 5 years, but just in terms of my own interest and my own reporting and my own study of it, I just don't think I was paying close enough attention. And I frankly came to realize that that was because there was something about this narrative of Erdogan being an AKP being pro-business that in the beginning had seemed to me to be a good thing. And I think that was even without me realizing that I had thought that, oh, okay, he's pro-business, which means that, you know, he's somewhat like us. And I mean, this is, I say this as someone who I would describe myself as a leftist, but still there is this desire, I think, on the part of Westerners or Americans or outsiders, especially to look at people who are identified as Islamists and you know, see how we can feel better about them. And I think that the fact that, you know, Erdogan had been using this sort of free market rhetoric that is so familiar to Americans, I think had been familiar and comforting to me as well. And so by the time of Soma, and this one miner said to me, you know, why didn't you come earlier here? And which is a very poignant comment. I think that I would have, if I could have answered him honestly, I would have said, well, because I think that I was caught up in this idea of Turkey's economic boom, just like a lot of people. And so, yeah, it just felt like there were a lot of things colliding in that one scene. And also the fact that once again, you know, some of the miners were talking about this deep American history with Turkey in terms of labor unions and anti-communism and everything else, and how that might have affected Turkey's economic policies and labor policies. So it just seemed like the obvious place to start.
One of the writers that you reference throughout the book is James Baldwin, and he spent about 10 years around the 1960s in Istanbul. Could you just reflect a bit on why Baldwin's work and perspective resonate so much?
Well, he is my favorite writer. He was my favorite writer, and he is one of the major reasons I moved to Istanbul. Actually, it was because he had said, and you know, I had learned that he had lived there, and he had said that he felt very comfortable there as a black and gay man. And I found this absolutely fascinating. And I think that the country and the city suddenly became this place of fascination for me, and I had never been there before. So it was part of the reason I wanted to go. It was a kind of romantic reason, you know, your favorite writer. But he had never written about Turkey, and what he had. As I discovered later, though, what he had done was he had given some interviews to Turkish journalists at the time about what he was learning living in Turkey. And amongst the things that he said was that he was recognizing this new empire that America was extending across the world. And he was seeing that in Turkey because, of course, Turkey was one of the, you know, main recipients during the Marshall Plan and of American aid during the Marshall Plan and the Truman Doctrine. And he was watching this with trepidation because he was thinking, well, my God, you know, this country has not solved its own problems yet, specifically about race. White Americans have not dealt with their problems with power. And if they're extending their empire across the world, then they're extending their problems across the world as well. And suddenly I could see how understanding the way that Baldwin portrayed the black-white relationship at home could help me understand the relationship between Americans and foreigners abroad. And I could use him as a kind of intellectual and moral guide. And I think that because he has such a huge effect on me, I just do use him as a guide. I think he has had a different impact on me than most people. So I use him, I try to use him throughout the book. Also because he's just such a wise man, and I think that people love reading him. So it was nice to include him in the book. I was lucky to.
And there were other very striking parts of the book where you describe going back to the US to report on some of the kind of terrible problems really in Mississippi with a failing and an unfair healthcare system. And you kind of reflect on the contrast between this and this domestic poverty and the US global power. And as I was reading those sections, I kept thinking about George Orwell's Road to Wigan Pier. Mm. And that book was published in 1937, and it describes Orwell kind of setting out for the industrial heartlands of the north of England. He documents these shocking working and housing conditions of miners and whatnot in Yorkshire and Lancashire. Now, of course, this was 1937, and it was when Britain was near the height of its kind of imperial power, but it still had all this poverty back home. So the similarity there with your book is obviously quite striking. Mm. I mean, was that a kind of conscious choice on your part to kind of contrast the domestic problems of the US with this still potent global power?
It just, you know, it just so happened that in 2012, I spent a lot of time in Mississippi, quite a lot of time. And it was after I had been living abroad for a few years. So I think that, you know, again, just, you know, Mississippi is really, it's the poorest state in the nation. It's kind of the proof, you could say, of sort of a failure of the American dream, because in the 60s, people were saying, you know, this is the state that we're going, this is how we're going to judge whether or not there is social justice in America. Because if this state does not improve, then we can assume that, you know, it does not. And it didn't really improve ever. And I mean, in some ways, it declined. And I think it was just especially striking to have lived abroad and then to have been looking at the different proclamations of American exceptionalism in different ways, and then to go back to this place that kind of exposes the lie at the heart of the myth. And I had never been there either. I had never been to a place quite like the Mississippi Delta. And of course, it is also the heart of American slavery. So I think that, you know, it seemed necessary, especially after the financial crisis and after, you know, the gross inequality in America had been exposed for what it is, it seemed necessary to include a portrait of the U.S. at home and to describe what it was like to come home and to see it differently for the first time.
There's another bit where you talk about an Iranian kind of healthcare scheme, really.
Yeah.
And, it's kind of an ironic kind of flip that you do, where you kind of say, look, this is what we can learn from these kind of systems that we would never think that we'd have to learn from. Just kind of talk a bit about that and how it kind of flips this idea of modernization on its head in a way.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the themes of the book, or one of the issues I talk about, is modernization theory. And of course, you know, at the time in the 50s and 60s, for the Americans, Iran was one of the countries that they saw as kind of, it was like a pet project. I mean, so was Turkey, which was that they wanted to help these countries so-called modernize. And that also meant, you know, to a certain degree, be more like the United States. And, you know, Iran under the Shah was one of those countries. And of course, it was also an autocratic and brutal country while it was being ruled by the Shah, and the Americans supported the Shah, sold weapons to the Shah, and many Americans lived on Iranian soil and worked for him. And this is something that we don't really talk about as much today or know that much about. But I think that what was so clever about what Dr. Aaron Shirley, who is a civil rights hero, he's now passed away, civil rights hero in Mississippi, is that he said, you know, I'm going to use this Iranian healthcare system, or try to use this model, as a way of showing how much the American model doesn't work. But the key there was that this Iranian healthcare system had actually been developed after the revolution under the Ayatollah. So it was, you know, basically developed by this country that is now our enemy, and that we see as kind of a backwards, or many people see as a backwards Islamic country, et cetera, et cetera. And so he was doing a very clever thing and saying, you know, I give up. America has not fixed our healthcare problems, and I'm going to borrow a healthcare system from its greatest enemy, and it probably will work out better. And actually, that healthcare system is that healthcare scheme that the Iranians used in the rural countryside was a very smart one, and a very simple one, but a very smart one. And so, yeah, I thought it was a really interesting story to show that flip, as you say.
Now, just to talk a bit more generally about your work, if possible, I think you came to Turkey in 2007. Yeah. So you've been reporting for around 10 years now, and obviously an awful lot has happened in that time, and you've reported on a lot of it, and you kind of describe in the book obviously what it's been like working in Turkey over that time. What was it like kind of combining this reporting with this kind of growing awareness of the US's global footprint and then putting it in a book at around the same time as you were reporting?
Well, it was hard because everything was changing in Turkey so quickly, and it was sort of a question. And also, I will say, you know, Turkey had not, I mean, as a freelancer, it had not been very much on the radar for, and I'm a freelance writer, on editor's radar. It was very, very hard to get pieces published about Turkey, which was why I went and wrote about lots of different places for many years. And so suddenly, and especially as I was working on this book, it was becoming more and more appealing to readers and to editors and to publishers. And so I think that as I was writing the book, in fact, my editor wanted me to make the book more about Turkey, whereas I hadn't really necessarily planned to have that much in there at the time, funnily enough. So that changed a lot as I was working on it. And of course, you know, I was just trying to get my head around everything that was happening. And so it's very hard to write a book when that is going on around you. But on the other hand, this is a book about me admitting all of the things I don't understand. So to some degree, it kind of worked. I could sort of chronicle my own attempts to understand what was happening in Turkey and my own confusion, and how much we still do not understand about the current situation. And that, of course, included Gezi, and it included Soma, and it included the, you know, uptick in violence, the bombings, the airport bombing, and the military, attempted military coup, and everything that has happened after. I mean, the book basically ends with the military coup, so attempted military coup.
And of course, really, over that 10 years, there's been a really big shift in the atmosphere that in the way that Turkey's seen abroad. Not so long ago, it was seen as a democratic model for the Middle East, and now it's kind of widely just dismissed really as a basket case. Could you just kind of reflect a bit on this shift and what you make of it?
I mean, I think that a lot of us who were in Turkey at the time, especially Turks, were very skeptical of this idea of Turkey as a model. If not only because, you know, it's very, very different from a lot of the countries that people were suggesting it could be a model for. I mean, it just has such a very specific history and trajectory and a complicated one. And so it didn't really make that much sense at the time. On the other hand, I do think that there were a few years in there that a lot of people in the Middle East said, okay, well, I might not be crazy about Erdogan or the AK Party, but it's pretty good. You know, it's at least it's working. But I don't think that there was ever the kind of enthusiasm that, you know, the West or Western writers were projecting. Again, this kind of reminds us of this tendency of Westerners and Western writers, and I implicate myself in this in the beginning, which is to see the Islamic world as a problem that needs to be solved. And this is the kind of well-meaning liberal mistake, you know, but it's a very dangerous one. And I think that, you know, for Turkey and for Turks also created this scenario in which people were suddenly just not seeing the dark things that were happening in Turkey behind the scenes. Or not so much behind the scenes. I mean, it was pretty out there in 2009, 2010, 2011. So I think that it was really a problem. And then to see it as a basket case, I mean, you know, of course, this kind of language is not desirable either, but if people will do it. And I don't know. I mean, it's obviously very upsetting what's happening in Turkey now. But I don't know if anyone could have really foreseen it, though. I guess a lot of people think they could.
Yeah, just, I don't know, everybody kind of has an idea, like, if you just followed my ideas at the time, you know, we were all saying this, you know, 10 years ago, why didn't anybody see it? I don't know, there's a grain of truth in all that stuff, but it always seems a bit too easy in a way.
There is a grain, yes, and I mean, I think that it's hard to remember what a strange time that was in different time in 2007, 2008. And I think that there was, simply because the military was threatening to intervene and because there was a lot of angry rhetoric towards Islamists or, you know, pseudo-Islamists or so-called Islamists, or towards the AK Party. And I think because they were also cleverly manipulating this situation or using the rhetoric of democracy and human rights, I think that it was just a very... It was easy to believe that this was going to all turn out well. And I think that, you know, a lot of that had to do with Turkey's history. I mean, a lot of people I remember during that time, especially minorities, they wanted to do away with the old Kemalist system. And that's not surprising either. And this party emerged as the one that seemed to be enthusiastic about doing that. And yeah.
I think in your most recent article published in the New York Times magazine, was this kind of long panoramic picture really of Turkey in the aftermath of the July 2016 coup attempt, and in the midst of this sweeping purge. And it's a very kind of vivid piece, and it really presents this kind of picture of almost a republic of fear, really. Could you just kind of talk a bit about reporting in Turkey since the coup attempt, what it's been like and how difficult it has been?
I mean, it's not difficult necessarily for me. Of course, as we know, it's difficult for Turkish journalists. difficult or impossible for Turkish journalists, and it's been a nightmare. And I think, you know, for me, I just felt that I wanted to. I usually get one article a year, basically, on Turkey, and I wanted to just really crystallize what was happening and the feeling of terror in the society. I think that it's, you know, I personally have been really heartbroken to see what's happening. The reporting, it's difficult because people don't want to talk. I mean, people are afraid to talk. And, you know, I don't see any reason in risking, you know, anybody's personal situation. So you have to go very, very carefully. You have to be very sensitive. And, you know, I think that with editors, you have to convince them, you know, they have a lot of rules about wanting to use people's names or initials or whatever. And you just can't. I mean, you can in this situation. You can't write the truth or get close to the truth if you're going to do that, because people are going to just be afraid to say what they really believe. And so it's a difficult situation, and it's a very stressful one. But, you know, foreign journalists have come under more pressure in recent years, but I personally haven't experienced anything.
Just finally, I think you're in the US at the moment for the launch of the book, but you'll be coming back to Istanbul, I believe. Are you planning to be staying in Turkey for the foreseeable future?
I think that I will always live there one way or another. I think that I have no plans to move as of now. I think that, you know, I have certain familial reasons for probably wanting to come back to the States more often. But I do love Turkey, and I love living in Istanbul, and I have a deep connection to it. So I hope to stay.
That was Susie Hansen. Many thanks to her. Remember, Turkey Book Talk listeners can support the podcast and get a 33% discount plus free delivery by purchasing any one of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. To check out the books available in that deal, visit the special page for it, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Another way to support the podcast is via my Patreon account, making a small or large pledge on a per episode basis. Many thanks to my current Patreon supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Jean-Marcus Vomo, Steve Bryant, Aaron Ataman, Max Hoffman, and Andrew McDowell. Also, don't forget to rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever platform you listen on, which really does help increase awareness of it for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes, and email recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until our next episode in a couple of weeks, thank you for listening.